Reading from Sri Bhakti Sandarbha, Anuchet 286. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Refinement of mixed worship. Although worship of the Buddhas or ghosts is described as part of the worship of the Lord, a pure devotee should not worship them because they do not belong to the associates who form the Lord's entourage. Furthermore, the worship of the Buddhas has been forbidden in the same part of the Padma Purana. Quote, the worship of the Yakshas, the Pisashas, and other celestial beings who eat meat and drink wine is understood as equal to drinking wine oneself. Om Janati Manandasya Jananjana Samakaya Aksurim Lakamya Sajmai Sivire Namaha Sita Tanya Manobitam Nafitam Nena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Padamayam Sudati Sapadam Sitam Adadana Sharam Dante Sidam Yache Puna Puna Shimad Rupa Padam Bhoja Tulisham Jan Midjani Vairagi Bhakti Risham Kriyatnai Apayam Amarabit Sumandam Kripam Buddhiya Paraduru Kuduti Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So greetings from Govardhan. I always would like to begin just maybe say a little something. Of course, this is the time of the year where so many of the devotees come. Yesterday I ran into the Tilakam party of Bibi Govinda Swami and Vajina Swami. It's out in front here of the Govardhan place. And then I went to Radhakund. I ran into Bhakti Chaitanya Swami and Omapad Swami. In fact, yesterday, I think Shri Krishna is here. You know him from New York. We went with another devotee, and we had a little small prakram, just three people. So we just chanted our japa and entered into Radhakund. And in all devotional activities, the essence of the activity is absorption in Krishna. When you go on prakram, a particular devotion is a particular absorption. Only Panchanga Bhakti. Only chanting Hare Krishna and serving devotees and hearing Kata and, of course, writing the Dham and chanting Hare Krishna. And we just chanted japa and we went to the different places. It's just so nice, an absorption. It's kind of when you make that kind of Chare Vata Hari Toshanani when the Guru went on pilgrimage. Chare Vata Hari, but he made a vow only to Hari. Because it's hard to make that about 24 hours a day, although we want to, because there's so many material responsibilities and obligations that we have that obviously are going to, unless one's at the highest platform, distract one from that kind of focus on Krishna, although it may be in the background, but it's not generally the same as the sadhana, although we should cultivate that type of consciousness also. One of the purposes of our sadhana is to spiritualize our consciousness so that whatever we do, we're seeing Krishna. But special in terms of your drip or your determination. When you say, you know, now is for Krishna only. And when you do that, if you do that concentration and there's a proper impetus to spiritual inspiration, you enter into a timeless region. And I think we all felt that yesterday. Because it was, you know, it was a type of absorption. We were walking, we were chanting, we were meeting devotees. We were just going from one place, Radha Gopinath Temple, Raghunath Das Goswami's Samadhi, went to Radha Kund, put a few drops on our head, sat by Janavabhaita, went in and saw the Bhajan Kutirs of Gopal Bhatta Goswami, Sangasad Goswami, Asta from Raghunath Das, Vishwanath Chakrabarti, of Raghunath Das, Krishna Das Kaviraj, Rasika Bhaktama. We sat in the place with Krishnadas Kaviraj, wrote the Chaitanya Charitamrita and chanted some japa and, you know, and associated with Narottam Das. The pujari walked around, saw the Jagannath temple, sat in Nityananda, finished 2 hours. If we weren't in the future, passion, we weren't in the past, ignorance. We were focused at the moment. When you focus at the moment, you transcend time. So that was a very, very nice experience. And then coming back and then seeing all the devotees there. So now we're studying Bhakti Sambhava, which is the premier treatise on the Abhidhaya Tattva, the science of the means of realizing the absolute reality, which is Bhakti. So it's the ultimate science of Bhakti. The ultimate description of what bhakti is, how you practice it, how to distinguish it, the different types of bhakti. And it's all referenced mostly from the Bhagavad Gita. So we're in the end of the Bhakti Sarada, where we'll discuss Vayu Bhakti and then Radhanuda Bhakti. So it's listing the different principles of devotional service. In a sadhana kram, in a step-by-step process, basically. And now it's discussing archana, or worship. So we've been discussing that for a few weeks. And basically, it described first the necessity of worship, or the necessity of worship, and worship means initiation. Because you can't worship without initiation. So what's the necessity of this if, you know, the holy name is sufficient in itself? What do you need to do this also? And it describes basically two things which are the key to deity worship and the necessity for deity worship. One, because of the guru or rules, including the prerequisite of initiation with certain obligations and duties, it helps you to prioritize spiritualizing, especially if you want a household life with so many other duties. Because it's an obligation or it's a duty. You have to do it. And the real deity worship, you know, no one eats unless they worship the deity. It's just like you have a guest in your house. A cultured person, you know, won't be eating before the guest. Not like the guest wakes up and he comes down and you're munching on the Cheerios. You kind of like look up, huh? You know? Not the culture. And in India, people would not even, they wouldn't do anything unless they at least saw the deity. They would go to the temple. It prioritizes spiritual life. And it regulates one. Otherwise, without regulation, without obligation, one falls victim to the mind. So though the holy name is sufficient in itself, because of the uncontrolled mind, we tend to commit offenses. So unless we adopt some other process to help us control light. You know, some obligation, regulation, duty. Hunter a tricky busy at the other track. It's hard to take full avail of the other processes. So this is what he's mentioned. And the second point, it helps one to develop a specific relationship with the wood, which is part of Rodmark. The Kinshiner was telling me yesterday, but it's the same point. He has a very good friend, Ananta, which is a good friend. He also looks up to him because he's so dedicated to the holy name and to kirtan. He's so expert at it. So he really loves kirtan, but Kinshiner thought, like, well, maybe we should go out on the street and do Nagar kirtan because he likes to chant in the temple. So Kinshiner asked him, he said, you know, why don't we go out and do Nagar kirtan? And he thought for a while. He said, okay, that's okay if you bring a picture of Radha Govinda. So he was young. His mother offered him to the deities. In fact, he was born in the temple. But there's sambandha. He worships Radha Govinda. It's a sambandha. It's a relationship. And Prabhupada generally gave that relationship not so much in personal deities, which is there in other lines, Vaishnava lines. You get initiated, you get a deity. The Balabas do that. And you get initiated, you get your Krishna. Go to live a room in Jatipur and have all these deities, and Vaishnava die and get back to deity. You go, well, where's my Krishna? You go, oh, there's your Krishna. It's sambandha. The Prabhupada did it by generally, not, you know, especially the early establishing temples. The deity you're on there, you know, you came to the lotus feet of Radha Govinda. And it's sambandha. There's some type of relationship there. And that relationship helps one enter into love. It's a spontaneous relationship with Krishna. So to have the focus of the deity is also... So you discuss that. And then there's a lot of discussion about Archana. This book is fascinating. But then he discussed that there's two types of worship. There's pure and there's mixed. There's Kevala. There's Kevala. And there's Kevala, and there's Mishra. It's mixed with karma, and that generally happens when, you know, you're born into a tradition, right? You know, it's not like you get Krishna consciousness to a bona fide spiritual master and you're initiated into pure devotional service. But it's the local custom. You tend to worship the deity not for a direct spiritual goal of developing a relationship with God, but either some traditional obligation or duty or for some material reason. Right? I always, when I thought, of course, we're talking about Radha Govinda, I remember just sitting in the Sunday feast and some of the Indians would come with a bag of rice and put it on the altar or some food. And many of them, their daughters weren't married because they're praying to the deity that please get my daughter married and had a business problem. You know, it's mixed, but he explained that, you know, and not only that, but there's certain regulations in societies and different pujas and different worships, etc., that are kind of purificatory to the general populace. You know, it regulates their life. It's a manifestation of God indirectly, the demigods, etc. So he also reckons you don't give that up necessarily. Even if you're a Vaishnava, if you're in that kind of culture, because you don't want to disrupt the social order because it has some purpose for others. But then he explains, well, how do you do it then? And I was explaining before that this type of discussion of worship, and one of the interesting things here is Jiva Goswami's audience is not necessarily us for this section. He's dealing with a culture that's, the whole society is worshiping deities. I respect that, you know, if they don't worship, you know, consider the demigods. equal independence of Krishna, you know?
Well, we grew up related to demigods.
Practically speaking.
Well, speak of worshiping the demigods, you know?
We were against them. We were Krishna bhaktis, and in our kind of like passion, you know, when you come into a new truth, you know? I remember walking Vrindavan and you like seeing a Durga deity or Shiva and think look like the enemy camp or something. You know, so it's you know, but it's interesting to look, but it's also relevant. You can also find relevance in it. So he says, well, how do you do it? You perceive the Lord's presence in all beings. That's one way. You worship demigods, you see that Krishna is the super soul of everyone. Why we sanctify the activities with contact with devotion. In other words, okay, there's a Durga worship, or in the family, or the master, you know, the culture, and then you offer the prasad of Krishna. Yeah, so that's the way to do it. And then he sees that in the society, and if you see the Chaitanya Charitamrita, what Bengal is like with the Shakya worship is, you know, I remember I had my godbrother in Purnachan, his name was. And he was a Bengali man, right? And he had just joined, right? And Prabhupada was walking around the temple with all his, like, big, heavy sannyasis. And I mean, the sannyasis were heavy in those days, you know. Like, you know, if you give a child a you know, some sharp object, it's dangerous. Or you give, like, you know, 19, 20, 22-year-old men big sticks, it's dangerous. Basically speaking. They're heavy, man, God, Brahmananda. It's like, really. The Prophet was taking his walk around the temple, and he ran up the Prophet. He said, can I go home to Durga Puja? Because he's Bengali, you know. I swear those sannyasis are ready to kill him. I go home to Durga Puja. But the people in that culture, it's so relevant, you know. He's dealing with that, and one of the things he sees is perhaps people either coming to Krishna consciousness or antagonistic to Krishna consciousness, they want to, you know, establish the worship of the demigods. You know. And what Jiva Goswami, and the way they do it is in Vaishnava meditation, there's a yoga pit meditation. And this is even in our Arjuna Puddhi, the Puddhi is even in the ISKCON worship, it's in the Bhajan Mahasya. There's a formal place that the Lord's worship in its eternal abode. And in deity worship, you know, you can meditate on that. And then I described in the yoga pit, it's Lord Chaitanya in the center, and you're meditating, and he's on a jeweled throne, and then, you know, to the right is Lord Nityananda in his blue dhoti, and the Gadhar in the red dhoti, and to the right on the bottom is Srivas blocking the sun rising on that side, and Dvaita on the other side, and Guru is below, and, you know, and then all the associates. And it's kind of like a meditation, like that. But these meditations, too, they can get very, very complex. And so also in those meditations, there's Durga and Ganesh, and it's a whole description, and it's pretty solid by Jiva Goswami that that's not the Durga and Ganesh of the material world, but they're eternal associates of the supreme world. And in fact, Durga can refer to Radharani because Durga has a particular meaning. Some meaning. He made it very, very clear. I mean, he went through this whole thing. In ways that Durga is mentioned, and then he ended up with this kind of, and he was making an argument, kind of, I guess, in English. I don't know if it's like, they have a Brit here before me, so I don't know if it's slam dunk.
Okay. It's a slam dunk. He comes up with this reference. You know, Jiva comes up with this reference. It's a slam dunk. And, you know, he mentions the associates of the Lord in the eternal abode and where they're situated. So, you know, among them, you know, is, you know, Satya Achyuta Ananta Durga, you know, they're in the fourth circle in Vaikuntha, and then the seventh circle, and then the eighth circle, and the southwest, and the, so they're all mentioned. And then he says, but the gods who reside in the material heavenly planets are not eternal. As stated in the Vedas, the gods who live in heaven are ephemeral. So he gives direct references. And he says that people use these descriptions to authorize deity worship. You can imagine saying, Prabhupada, can I go to Durga Puja? It says in the yoga pit meditation that Durga is like that. For the modern context of it. But actually, then he said, it cuts the other way. Because they're eternal associates of the Lord, they should be worshipped. The eternal Durga, the eternal Ganesh. In that type of yoga pit, sanctum, sanctorium worship. So he gives he gives this argument. But what I found intriguing is what's going on at the time of Jiva Goswami. You know? You know, we could have like a parody spoof or something that there was internet like 500 years ago, you know? And like, you know, there's people promoting the worship of the demigods, you know, online, and, you know, drawing diagrams in the yoga pit, you know. There are other people running in out of town, and they have their own controversies there. They're probably a little bit more sophisticated than ours. Now, this thing that mentions about the ghost now. Because in some of these descriptions, you see, what he mentioned is well, which do you follow? He said, you follow the one in your life. But how do you know how to worship the deity? Well, you follow your own sampradaya. But there's different lines, so these yoga pits and descriptions, you may come upon different ones, and then, so some of them may include the Buddhas or ghosts. Because some of them just include everything. You'll see that. You know, they include everything as part of God's creation somehow. And you know. But he says a pure devotee should not worship them. So it may be in some kind of worship, some kind of mixed worship, some Vaishnavas, you know, family to is some kind of worship, but a pure devotee should not worship because they don't belong to the associates of the Lord. They're actually Lord Shiva's associates. And this has been condemned, and Jiva Goswami condemns it. So now you'll see some points that come out. It's not like you feel like so relevant to you, but at the time, there must have been people, there's always people that abuse scripture for their own sense gratification. You see, this is something I understood very clearly, that enjoyment takes two things. It takes three things. This is my own analogy. It takes sensual stimulation, ego gratification, right? It's not that you enjoy the senses, but it has to make you feel that I'm superior to other people. And it must be without guilt. So without guilt, what it means is every time you're enjoying something, subtly you're trying to make a justification. And according to your sincerity or not, is the degree that you'll rationalize. Or the degree of your attachment is the degree you'll rationalize. So we basically see, even in the Vaishnava community today, whatever someone's doing, they have a quote from Prabhupada. where they have some kind of rationalization. So basically, their philosophy is to support their attachment. And therefore, when you challenge people's philosophy, the reason why they become so angry and go on the internet with 1,000 articles is because you're not attacking their philosophy. Oh, of course, people defend the Shastra's tradition, but a lot of it is because you're destroying their enjoyment, introducing guilt into what they do. And what's protecting them from guilt is their rationalization. And that's why also, in terms of keeping the faith of the disciple or student, a teacher cannot give them the whole truth until he's faithful and surrendered. Because a lot of the truth is, one, going to be different than what that person sees, right? Because the person has attachment, so it affects his vision and his philosophy. So it's going to be different from what he sees. And it's going to be rooted in his attachment. So first, it'll be attacking his attachment. It'll be attacking his conception. And because the attachments are backing his conceptions, he's going to support his conceptions rather than yours in a rude state. The guru is speaking different than what I say, and it's not right. And I have my shastra. He's wrong. Especially, you know, let's take the ideal matter, the bona fide guru, and in this case, the attached disciple. And I look at him and say, I can't give this guy everything. It's just too much different from the way he sees, and he's too attached. And if I do it, he's just going to think I'm lost. But if he's fully surrendered, then he gets everything. And, you know, we all have that, even in our relationships. It's like, you know, most of the people out there are looking, are married, right? How many things would you like to tell your spouse that you can't? How many things would you like to tell your spouse that you can't? Why? Because either the man or the woman have different attachments. And you can't tell them. You can't tell them the truth. Why? Because there's an attachment behind it. So even though Swami's still dealing with this, so this is far out. Therefore, other gods whose worship is compulsory cannot be worshipped with forbidden articles, such as wine, even though these items may be acceptable to them. So some of the demigods, I guess, in these worships, they themselves take unacceptable things, but you can, as a Vaishnava, offer it to them in this mixed worship. If he's talking, it may be a compulsory, a traditional thing you have to keep. Now, what do? That's what his point is now. And he said, as in the case of Balaram and other deities, because Balaram drinks wine. So, you know, yeah, offer the virility to Balaram. You know, and get stuck. They get stoned. And get drunk. Then again, irreligion and the three constituent qualities of material nature, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, are also included as part of the worship of the Lord's Sanctum Sanctorium. So everything's there, including all the modes of material nature, somehow. I don't know how that's in the yoga pit. In religion, etc. So it says, all of this I'm not going to have realized or be able to understand. So yet the Padma Purana and the Swayambhuva Atama make no mention of this. Therefore, these attributes are not given any credence when we accept this such worship. So he's saying, well, certain shastras say they're not even there. So I guess when it comes down to it, all these pujas are met, you know, things are added, and, you know, and which ones are authorized, and if it's part of your tradition, this is what you do. I guess, you know, you can't, I guess even though Swami's very practical, you just can't rip out people's traditions. It's kind of like the fabric of society. So how do you deal with it? Now you're a Vaishnava. Okay, well, don't, now if that's part of it, don't be offering things that those deities just like we take, okay, worship those deities. but it's a social consideration, and see the Supreme Lord in that, and offer the remnants to that. That's what he's basically saying. He says here, in some shastras, they're not even given any credence. I guess he's had his little sensitivity. Because they're preaching in Bengal, and it's people have so many different conceptions and ideas. You know? And I guess a lot of people out there, I'm a sannyasi, not as much in the world, but having to deal with family and family customs and things that families believe and expect, you know, and which one should you do? You know, you're Catholic, and your mother is a devout Catholic and wants your kid confirmed. But you're now a Vaishnav. Should you get them confirmed or not? And how and why? You know, I guess they would have been Shastra for that. You know, it's a whole Catholic society. A lot of them becoming Vaishnavas. Okay, do we uproot the whole thing, and do we follow a few of their things? And if we do it, how do we do it? I guess this is, you know, even like with names, you know. I know that some devotees, they're hesitant to give, usually not, because most devotees just like left family already, you know, at some kind of mood. But as it becomes kind of more mainstream and things, there's the other consideration. So some, I've seen some give them a kind of a Western name, and Nathan Keshava, Oliver Rupa, Alexander Pollard, you know. But sometimes people do that. There's actually even one of the most learned gurus in Vrindavan. A friend of mine is initiated by him. When he initiates people, he doesn't change people's names. The one guy got initiated from him, who I knew from New Jersey. Yeah. I was going to say, he would have joined the Brooklyn Temple, but he got mugged on the way there, to the A train. His name was Steve. He got initiated. His name was Steve. You know, good respect. That's what he's called in society. Why confuse them? So I'm just saying, these kind of considerations go on. There's also a good reason to change the names, too. A very good reason to change the names. And that's going to come up because of identity. Because you have to understand, you know, the false ego has an identity in this life, and the identity of the false ego is what? It's whatever your name was. You know, so just for practicality in the other sense, not to connect everything, you know, before you change the name, try to get another identity. You know, what we do is we ruin the names because we just act the same way. And it comes a point that, you know, if a devotee is a good devotee and he does bad, then you ruin that name, right? I'm not only criticized because I feel people are sincere, they make mistakes, but I'll just give a practical example. How many people have named their kid Kirtananda? You know? Or Bhagavan, you know? So we take those names and we make a whole other material conception of them. But I know one guru, when he gave sannyas to someone, he wanted to save the name from a previous sannyasi who was fallen. And he named that sannyas guru the same name to purify the name. And it worked. What can I do with this purport? Somehow I will offer a different explanation of the religion and similar attributes based on Narada Pancharatna, as stated there itself. So this is in Pancharatna, which is our line, but it says, irreligion, ignorance, absence of detachment, and impotence, these four are used for inauspicious purposes, end quote. According to this statement,
irreligion, ignorance, and similar characteristics are understood as potencies of the super soul operating in people who manifest these traits.
So somehow or other, it's, I guess, this kind of, if you worship them, then you worship the super soul. Somehow is manifesting these traits in people. I guess it's a way to purify looking at the world. I have a god brother, and he's very, very deep in his internal meditation. Very, very advanced spiritually. And you don't know it because they don't reveal. So I'm a close friend, so he reveals. And so he tries to meditate, you know, on all Vaishnavas, etc. You know? And he tries to worship all the Vaishnavas. But being in an institution, there's a whole group of god brothers that are so much different from his mood. And even if harassed in his times, you know? They're like the more conservative faction. But what he does is he meditates on them and offers them respect every morning. He meditates on the ones because he wants to see their sincerity, offer them respect. And he says he meditates them as the Vipaksha. You know what Vipaksha means? It's Svapaksha and Vipaksha. In Radharani's pastimes, there's two gopis. One is Svapaksha, the other ones that are your close friend. And Vipaksha, he means against, and there's the ones that are against. There's Chandravali, Shaivya, Bhadra, Chandravali's group. You know, you also worship them, but they're against. So he has a group of god brothers that are Vipaksha. They're against. So he tries to put it in that type of line. You know, even the spiritual, there's people that are on the opposing party. But they're still serving Krishna, eternal associates. In the sanctum sanctorium, the shoes of the preceptor should be worshipped on the left side of the Lord, as it is said, quote, the same Lord who descends as a devotee and thus exists in the world in his individual features, the preceptor, also exists in his collective feature as the totality of all groups. So there's Yasti and Samasti. Yasti is individual, Samasti is collective. In that sanctum sanctorium, there's also the concept of Guru Tattva, the collective Guru, which manifests individually in different ways. He is situated on the left side of the Lord, although he himself is a direct incarnation. So this expansion is a direct incarnation. And the worship, now this part is really far out. I don't even know how tight it's so far out, this part. What it describes is that in the material world, the Lord's pastimes require a mixture of the Lord's eternal associates and people from the material world. Isn't that far out? And it describes that sometimes, I'm giving a little summary, it describes that sometimes eternal associates or something empower living entities with their potency. And those living entities, they take the names of those eternal associates, but if they have bad association, they can deviate. And he's going to give you an example of Vidya. The Vidya in this world and the Vidya in the eternal abode are different because the Vidya is one of Ram's eternal associates. He's going to describe how this happened. Now, I'm trying to figure out his mind what he's actually seeing. He's fascinating. I can see you looking at him. I had a little audience today. It's good to have an audience because I can use my ability to read minds. It's harder to do over the phone. I got an audience that I'm seeing. It's really interesting stuff. Wow. In the worship of Lord Ram, deities who form part of the outer circle, such as Mainda and Grivida, should be understood as belonging to the Lord's eternal abode, and as such they are eternal and pure. They're not the other Grivida who turns against Balaram. As evidence of the fact that the devotees form part of the eternal associates surrounding the Lord, we cite the story of Akula's vision. So, the basic is to say these are devotees, although they have names and demons in the world. So when you do this worship of Brahman, you read a Krishna book, and it's there, you know, it's a different person. Somehow or other, this was relevant to his preaching. I could imagine, you know, putting this in the Bhakti manual or something for the modern people today, you know. You know, you don't try to clear up problems that people don't have because they're ignorant of them. When Akula went to bathe in the Jamuna in order to chant the Adha Marsana mantra, he saw Kalad and others encircling the Lord. So when he went to bathe, Akula, when he came to Vrindavan, he went and he had a vision of the yoga pit in Lord. The same Kalad became a calf when King Prithu milked the earth and would assume the form of a cow. This shows that Kalad is an eternal associate of the Lord who manifests momentarily for this specific purpose. Otherwise, Prahlad had not yet taken birth, which was during the Swayambhuva Mandatar. He was born of Angakashipu only in the Chakshusha Mandatar. So it says that he manifests three Mandatars later as Angakashipu. So that's not it's an eternal associate who manifests here. That's what it's actually saying. In this case, it's the same Prahlad. And he keeps on manifesting for different purposes. Other devotees, there's a different thing. Now there are people who are not the eternal, that's the eternal associate. Now there are people that are not the eternal associate. Other devotees, however, are living beings of this world. Some come that have the same name, like Kalat, but others are not. They're devotees of this world, who are endowed with the power of the Lord's eternal associates, such as Mainda and Devita, the rest bear the same names. So one, they come directly, another, they empower people that are of this world. When Lord Rama and others, other incarnations who eternally manifest on a boat here in the world, these devotees are thus empowered to assist in their pastimes. The Devita was also in Rama's pastimes, so he was empowered to assist the people in this world. This is such a fascinating point. However, due to the association with those idolaters who are inimical to the Lord's devotee, Sugriva, and in later millennium, due to the association of those like Narakasura, who are inimical to Lord Krishna, Mainda and Vidura, who are empowered beings who most became collective. So there can be devotees in this world, the Lord comes to their side. They empower some, the eternal associates don't come, but they empower people to play those roles. They get bad association and they become corrupted. Now, to try to figure this out completely logically, if it's the Supreme Lord, or the associate, how can they become corrupted? It's evidently in a whole other dimension here. This sort of phenomenon occurs because the Lord's descent is made possible by only a mixture of the Lord's eternal associates and people from the world. This can be other far-out points coming up in the discussed deity worship, because I went ahead. One was really far-out. it describes that the demons in the spiritual world, I got to find this one. This is like coming to attraction. It's just like, wow. The demons exist but not as conscious entities. Like some painting. It's like an idea. Right? It's either a painting or like a statue. They don't actually exist as conscious entities. And when the Lord needs them, they manifest. So much going on here. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to stop a little bit earlier with the questions rather than continue with the text. But this is so much, at least I find it fascinating. How it describes Rukmini in Gokula, who's that, you know, what's going on. What about how the Ganga in Vrindavan, that's discussed. How can the sun and the moon be in Vrindavan? And the material planets, what does that mean? It's really fascinating. I mean, you can imagine Jiva Goswami sitting in Vrindavan. You know, he's really the preacher, isn't he? He's like looking at the people, what people are thinking, how to establish Krishna consciousness. And he writes all these books without a computer. And so it's in his mind, he's got one shot at the palm leaf. It's not like the leaf X or something, like don't see copy or put on your track changing. Like in the mind, it's all going on in the mind. Computer the whole thing in the mind. Because if you do it that way, their minds become stronger. Modern civilization is meant to weaken our minds with all these machines. You don't develop a strong mind because, you know, everything, their memory, you know, it just doesn't develop. People would have to do what we do now, people would have to develop greater mental powers. So the society the Brahmins would develop greater mental powers. They had no choice. Now you just go in your word process. It doesn't matter what mode you're in. Cut and paste. Put something together. Okay, are there any questions? I think we've got a question to be asked. Are there any questions? I have a question here with my audience here. Go ahead.
I'm looking at that here,
he described that there's pure worship and mixed worship. And mixed worship means, you know, you can't purely worship Krishna because you're in a social context where there are certain gods and demigods that are worshipped. And they serve a function in a particular society to regulate that society. So how do you do that how do you do that as a devotee? So he describes two ways. You see the super soul, or you may not be able to give up super soul, you spiritualize it by offering the remedy. And so then he gets into the question of the Vaishnava's relationships with demigods. And then he brings up this problem, how the demigod worship is supported on the basis of different pujas. Where you have this yogic hypnotic method of meditation. And he wants to show that the eternal associates that are mentioned there are not the same people that are in the material world. Like Durga,
for example, is a partial manifestation of the Maya Shakti. The Durga in the spiritual world is only Sarup Shakti, so it can't be the same. There's only Sarup Shakti, and he gives verses. And in the spiritual world, there's only Sarup Shakti. So the Durga here is a manifestation, but because they're the same way, you can see all kinds of problems that arise. People supporting the Durga worship here on the basis of what they read in that chapter. Now when it gets to the ghost and things, like it's one Jiva Goswami is getting into this subject, he might as well discuss all kinds of customary or, you know, shastric, you know, yoga pit meditations where it, you know, I guess in a purificatory process, it starts to show everything that's manifest and how you deal with it as a Vaishnava. And then he gets into other effects about it. Well, sometimes the deities that you worship in these creatures, they have forbidden things. So what do? He's instructing people because I guess people come into these problems. Well, what do? Well, you know, if you have to worship the demigods, well, don't offer them the radicals, or, you know, how do you see this? You see the super soul, like that. That makes sense? Well, the thing mentioned about Ram is just another point of the same thing, that these eternal associates, they can come, they can actually come, as Prahlad comes. Or this is another fact. It's not the demigods, it's the eternal associates themselves. Not the demigods, eternal associates. It's the eternal associates. They're not demigods.
To purchase more credit,
they're eternal associates that appear, or they empower others.
That's 611.
And how to understand that? Well, they empower
these people. Will end in 30 seconds.
And now the person's become demoniac. Well, how? Both the association and these other demons. You know, but now, when you're a Ram doctor, right, and now you're doing the yoga pit, and then it sees the Vidya, and what, you know, what's going on? Well,